We're reporting this morning on some practical problems with saving the planet. World leaders are gathering in Copenhagen, hoping to work out a deal on climate change. That's proving to be very hard, yet the real challenge comes later. Each nation has to find its own way to reduce greenhouse gases. And Americans face their own challenges. NPR's Richard Harris reports on one possible source of more energy.
Nuclear power poses a major conundrum. Nobody's thrilled about nuclear waste. People fear potential accidents, and proliferation of nuclear weapons is downright scary. On the other hand, nuclear plants generate lots of power and very little carbon dioxide. And when people crunch the numbers to see how to phase out carbon dioxide emissions, they often come up with this answer.
My view is that nuclear has to play a major role.
Richard Meserve is president of the Carnegie Institution for Science. He used to chair the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he served on a recent National Academy of Sciences committee looking at the future of energy in America.
Nuclear technology is something that's there. We know how to do it. There's no technical challenge in being able to apply it, unlike many of the other technologies.
For example, there's no proven technology to capture and store carbon dioxide from coal plants. So Meserve says the challenge in nuclear isn't technology, it's money.
These plants are very expensive at the front end. Wall Street lost a lot of money when we built our existing nuclear plants because of the long time to construct the plants in a period of very high interest rates.
So even though there are now 26 applications pending for new reactors, most everyone seems to be timid to take the financial plunge.
If you have a nuclear plant with all-in costs of $8 to $9 billion, that's a bet your company proposition.
The federal government is talking about loan guarantees and other incentives to help plants get over that hump. Some see that as a giveaway to the industry. Others see that as needed to keep nuclear in the mix. Tom Turbush at the Electric Power Research Institute says his utility-funded group is agnostic about where power should come from. But when they look at the deep carbon cuts being promised for the next decade or two,
that's really tough. And I think one of the reasons that nuclear, among a lot of different things, but why nuclear is actually an important piece of that would be these are big baseload plants. Yes, they take a few years to build, but we know how to build them. Once you build them, a typical unit, a generating unit, can probably produce enough power for nearly 1 million homes. So it's a big chunk.
Turbush says every option has its challenges. You'd have to put up more than 1,000 wind turbines, for example, to match the power output of a single nuclear plant. So his organization figures that nuclear needs to play a substantial role along with every other technology that produces clean power.
If you're putting all your eggs in one or two or three baskets, even if you just put all your eggs in the nuclear basket, say, that probably won't get you to where you need.
Others who look at the mix of future power options are not so sanguine about nuclear. Ellen Vanko is at an environmental group called the Union of Concerned Scientists.
While it may sound convenient or easy to just throw a few thousand megawatt nuclear power plants on the ground, it's not necessarily cost effective.
Her group's analysis shows that the cheapest thing to do is to reduce demand for electricity by improving efficiency. Of course, there's also a challenge in motivating tens of millions of homeowners to insulate their attics and to replace old freezers. Some hardline environmental groups like Greenpeace remain staunchly opposed to nuclear power, even in the face of climate change. But the Union of Concerned Scientists, for one, is holding its nose and saying we can't afford to shut the door entirely on nuclear power.
But there's a huge difference between calling for a limited number versus, as some are suggesting, 100 new nuclear power plants being built between now and 2030.
What ultimately happens will probably depend on the experience with those next few plants. Richard Meserve from the Carnegie Institution says he expects 6 to 8 new plants to go into operation by 2020.
How fast we deploy them after that will likely be driven by the experience with the early plants. Can we build them on budget? Can we build them on time? Do they work economically?
Right now, nuclear power provides 20% of the nation's electricity. With no new plants, that number would gradually decline, even as the demand for clean power grows. Richard Harris, NPR News.
As efforts to curb global warming continue in Washington and at this week's Copenhagen summit, there may be a partial solution in the fields of Marin County, California. It's called carbon ranching. The idea is to coax carbon dioxide out of the air and to capture it in the grass and soil of pastureland. NPR's Christopher Joyce explains.
Marin County isn't just hot tubs and wineries. Try going up to where the cows and deer live.
So in another month or so, this road becomes really challenging.
It's not challenging now.
No, this is pretty good.
Wendy Silver is steering a Jeep up a hill as steep as a ski slope. Silver is a soil scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. If soil is the Earth's skin, then Silver might as well be its dermatologist.
What we're interested in doing out here is trying to figure out how much carbon is added to the soil and how much carbon is lost.
Soil and plants that grow in it depend on carbon. Plants mostly absorb it from carbon dioxide. Essentially, it's a plant food. Silver wants plants to eat more.
So this is a compost plot.
Silver has spread compost over plots of pasture land, a mix of plant clippings, food waste, the kind of stuff you put on your garden.
And what that does is it increases plant growth. It actually also lowers the temperature a little bit, so the soils don't get quite as hot. It doesn't stimulate as much microbial activity.
You can see the grass is taller here. That means more carbon in the plants and more food for cows. Ranchers like that part. But those microbes, Silver mentions, are tricky. Soil is full of them, and when they eat plants and animals and bugs, they emit carbon dioxide into the air. So Silver's composting has to work a delicate balance between supercharging plants but not microbes.
What we're really trying to do here is understand what makes the microbes go and what makes the plants go.
So far, the grass in the composted plots grows so well that it captures 50% more carbon from the air than grass in the untouched plots. And the soil is taking up almost all the carbon in the compost, carbon that most likely would have gone up into the atmosphere if it hadn't been added to the pasture land. Silver is now measuring exactly how much that is. To do that, her team pounds plastic domes into the ground. They capture the greenhouse gases seeping up from the soil. But Silver says just the extra grass from composting could make a big dent in greenhouse gas emissions, especially in this part of California.
Grasslands, because they're in these dry regions, have really, really high root biomass. It tends to go pretty deep. Those plants are looking for water. And that's what builds that dark, organic-rich soil and that carbon-rich soil.
Silver thinks composting could work for about 30 years before the soil is saturated with carbon, and during that time, ranchers could get paid for the practice.
Hopefully they'll be able to participate in a carbon market where we can quantify how much carbon is being stored on the land, and they can sell that as a carbon offset.
That idea intrigues John Wick. His back deck looks out over his grazing land, where Silver is conducting her experiments, which are part of the Marin Carbon Project.
Now I think about carbon in everything I'm doing, and it's completely changed my life. This whole ecosystem down there is alive. I mean, up until this point, it was just dirt to me, and something I pushed around with my bulldozer.
You know, all these things sound good, but you got to look at the cost of them all and see
Absolutely.
What the payback is.
Yeah.
Bob Giacomini is a little more skeptical. Giacomini stands in a trailer above a milking room at his dairy farm. It's noon, and he's already been up 8 hours. Wendy Silver is trying to persuade him to try composting to see if his pastures will grow better as well as store more carbon.
I'm certainly interested in finding that out. I mean, how much time and or money am I willing to put forward to find that answer, you know?
That's where the carbon market would come in. If a climate law is passed, industries will be looking for ways to reduce their carbon footprint. Paying farmers to soak up carbon in their pastures could be one way to do that. As for the time and know-how, there's a new office in the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C., designed to create a market for exchanges just like that. Sally Collins runs it.
The potential for landowners is huge. So we started looking at that as a way to keep people on the land.
Because land that stores carbon would generate extra income. Actually, measuring carbon in soil and plants isn't easy, though. Collins acknowledges that a market won't work unless the buyers and sellers know exactly what they're getting.
We have got to figure out how to have one set of scientifically based, credible standards.
Standards to measure exactly how much carbon stays in the soil and the grass, and even what happens to it after the microbes or the cows eat it. It sounds complicated, and it is. But as negotiators at the Copenhagen climate meeting struggle with ways to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere, storing carbon in soil and plants may start to look pretty attractive. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Children.
Children who have trouble reading usually do a lot better if they receive intensive instruction. And now, scientists have discovered one reason why. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, a new study shows that intensive reading programs produce measurable changes in the structure of a child's brain.
Reading involves a lot of different parts of the brain. Some recognize letters, others apply knowledge about vocabulary and syntax, and still others decide what it all means. Somehow, the brain has to synchronize all these operations. Marcel Just, who directs the Center for Cognitive Brain Imaging at Carnegie Mellon University, says that requires a really good communication system.
You need these sort of high-speed, I don't know what to call them, highways between brain areas to let the information flow back and forth extremely effectively.
If those information highways can't handle the traffic, the brain won't be able to make sense out of the text. Just wondered whether this might be part of the problem for a lot of children struggling to read. So he and a colleague named Timothy Keller used a special type of MRI to look at the brains of several dozen poor readers as young as 8. The team focused on the network of fibers that carries information around the brain. That's a kind of brain tissue called white matter.
Tim Keller and I scanned these children and found that there was an area of white matter that was of lower structural quality than in the control group.
The control group being kids with typical reading skills. During the next school year, some of the poor readers were enrolled in programs that provided a total of 100 hours of intensive remedial instruction.
These children were really practicing how to read words, how to sound out words and read sentences over and over and over again. And that repeated remediation training is what changed not just their reading ability, but changed the tissues in their brain.
A second round of MRI scans showed that the quality of white matter had improved in the same areas found to be lacking before the kids got intensive instruction. Just says there was no change among children in standard classes, and he says
the amount of improvement in the white matter in an individual was correlated with that individual's improvement in his reading ability.
The finding adds to the evidence that learning involves more than just gray matter, the brain tissues that process and store information. Doug Fields works in the Child Health and Human Development section at the National Institutes of Health. He says the realization that white matter is also important for learning has led to a shift in the way many scientists view the brain.
By analogy, we were looking at a transistor, and now we're looking at the whole network, like the internet, and realizing for this whole network to operate, you need to have an efficient flow of information.
Field says other studies have shown that white matter also changes when people learn to juggle or play a musical instrument. And he says white matter seems to be involved in a wide range of brain function and dysfunction.
Psychiatric illnesses, mathematical ability, IQ. Really, the more we look, the more we find.
Marcel Just says there's even evidence linking autism to problems with white matter and a lack of synchrony in the brain. The new study appears in the journal Neuron. John Hamilton, NPR News.
If your ears cannot quite hear what someone is saying, you might want to try listening with your skin. New research shows that sensations on the skin can help you understand speech. NPR's John Hamilton has the story, so listen up.
It's been clear for a long time that hearing involves more than just our ears. Brian Jick is a professor of phonetics at the University of British Columbia.
From our brain's point of view, we can hear with our eyes.
Jick says that's why people in a noisy room are more likely to understand someone if they can see the speaker's lips. But Jick wanted to see whether hearing could also be influenced by our sense of touch. So we had a graduate student round up some volunteers. They listened to a person making speech sounds, pa, ba, ta, da. Meanwhile, the graduate student stood by with a turkey baster.
She would squirt a little puff of air from the turkey baster onto the neck of the perceiver. And people had very strong responses to it.
Specifically, people did a much better job recognizing certain consonants when they were accompanied by a puff of air. That's not as odd as you might think. The sounds in question were pa and ta. To make those sounds, the mouth sends out a little burst of air. In contrast, the sounds ba and da do not come with a burst. And the brain seems to know that. Jick confirmed this with a high-tech version of the turkey baster experiment. He used an automated device to deliver tiny, precisely timed puffs of air to a person's hand or neck while they listened to audio recordings with a lot of background noise.
Ta, ba, ta, da.
What we found was that the little puff of air would cause them to be more likely to report having heard a sound like pa, even if what had actually been played to them was ba.
Jick says what's really interesting about this is that people don't normally use their skin to understand speech, yet they did it automatically. Jick says that suggests our brains are wired to incorporate information from other senses when we listen.
From my point of view, we're whole body perceiving machines, and we just take all of the information that comes at us in our environment and merge it into a percept of something that happened in the world.
That's an idea that's becoming widely accepted among brain scientists. David Ostry is a professor of psychology at McGill University in Montreal. A few months ago, he did a different experiment that involved touch and hearing.
We put small plastic tabs on the side of the cheeks, and we had a robot basically pull on the facial skin.
People did a better job recognizing a sound if the robot tugged their facial skin in the same direction it would have moved if they'd been making the sound themselves. Ostry says these days, the big scientific question isn't whether our brains routinely integrate sensory information, but how.
Really, it's up for grabs where within the brain this kind of integration is happening.
Ostry says it could be happening in areas that process sensory information, or in the motor cortex, which controls our muscles. Research on how hearing is influenced by other senses could help people with hearing loss or people like airline pilots who need to understand speech in noisy environments. The new study appears in the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
We are nearing the end of a week of Nobel Prizes. President Obama, of course, made the news, but Carol Greider won a Nobel Prize as well, and she's now enjoying the benefits. Yesterday, the King of Sweden presented her with the prize for medicine. She and NPR's Joe Palca have been friends since they met on a bike ride in Alaska 17 years ago. Palca traveled to Stockholm for her medal ceremony and filed this report.
The Nobel Prize Committee informed Carol Greider last October that she'd won this year's prize in medicine. Since then, she's been flying pretty high. Parties, interviews, speeches. But when I called her last week before she left for Sweden, she sounded more like a mom getting ready for summer camp than a prize-winning scientist.
There's always a lot of last-minute little things.
Like what?
Oh, I had to pack for Charles and for Gwendolyn, and I'm packing his shoes and realizing he doesn't have any dress socks.
Charles and Gwendolyn are Carol's children. Charles is 13, Gwendolyn 10. One of the toughest problems Carol faced before she left was deciding who to invite.
Although, you know, 16 people can come as my guests, there are some events that only take 8 and other events that only take 4 and other events that only take 5. So figuring out who goes to each one of those events was like planning 4 simultaneous dinner parties.
Have you worked out an algorithm for that?
No, I just sat there with a piece of paper and my brain.
And it's a pretty potent brain. Carol won the prize for her work on something called telomerase, an enzyme critical for cells to keep dividing. The key discovery came in 1984 when she was still in graduate school. Nobel Week in Stockholm is full of events, concerts, receptions, dinners, and a lot of thank yous.
I'd like to start by thanking the Nobel Committee. I'd like to say it's a real privilege to be here today.
That was Carol's Nobel lecture on Tuesday at the Karolinska Institute. Finally, yesterday it was time to actually hand out the awards. Before the ceremony, Carol's kids and friends gathered in the lobby of the Grand Hotel to take pictures of each other in their gowns and tails. Earlier in the day, Carol had gone to rehearsal. I asked her what she was supposed to do.
Walk, walk, walk. Bow, bow, bow. Turn around, walk, walk, walk.
Funny. She's smart enough to win the Nobel Prize, but the Nobel organizers apparently felt she needed practice with walking. Carol's daughter, Gwendolyn, wanted to know if she bowed to the king and queen.
No, you bow to the king, you bow to the assembly, the Nobel Assembly, and then you bow to the audience. And if you bow too deeply, they all say wow, and then it's bow wow.
Gwendolyn seemed to appreciate the joke, although maybe she was just being polite. The ceremony is held at the Concert Hall in Stockholm. About 1,500 people attend. Rune Tuftgård of the Karolinska Institute introduced Carol, as well as Elizabeth Blackburn and Jack Szostak, the two other scientists who share this year's prize in medicine.
I now ask you to step forward to receive your Nobel Prizes from the hands of His Majesty the King.
Then it was time for walk, 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 bow, bow, bow. She did it perfectly. Joe Palka, NPR News, Stockholm.